The reading for today is taken from Daniel chapter 9, verses 20 to 27. While I was speaking and praying... Sorry, I need you to find the page first. So, Daniel chapter 9, verse 20. While I was speaking and praying, confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel, and presenting my plea before the Lord my God, for the holy hill of my God. While I was speaking in prayer, the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the first, came to me in swift flight at the time of the evening sacrifice. He made me understand, speaking with me and saying, O Daniel, I have now come out to give you insight and understanding. At the beginning of your pleas for mercy, a word went out, and I have come to tell it to you, for you are greatly loved. Therefore, consider the word and understand the vision. 70 weeks are decreed about your people and your holy city, to finish the transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal both vision and prophet, and to anoint a most holy place. Now therefore, understand that from the going out of the word to restore and build Jerusalem, to the coming of an anointed one, a prince, there shall be 7 weeks. Then, for 62 weeks, it shall be built again with squares and moat, but in a troubled time. And after the 62 weeks, an anointed one shall be cut off, and shall have nothing. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Its end shall come with a flood, and to the end there shall be war. Desolations are decreed. And he shall make a strong covenant with many for 1 week, and for half of the week he shall put an end to sacrifice and offering. And on the wing of abominations shall come one who makes desolate, until the decreed end is poured out on the desolator. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Well, I'm sure you're all deeply envious of me having the privilege of preaching on this passage. You've been sitting there thinking, I wish I could have a go at preaching this passage, haven't you? Let's pray. Let me pick up on that song we sung earlier. O breath of life, come sweeping through us. Revive your church with life and power. O breath of life, come cleanse, renew us, and fit your church to meet this hour. Amen. Well, let me begin with a recap from last week, the first half of this chapter. You may remember a great prayer, one of the great prayers of the Bible by Daniel. And here would be one way of summing up that first section. First of all, he pretty much says, you have given us what we do deserve. You may remember that meant God had kept his promises. But in this case, God had kept his promises of judgment. And secondly, in the second, or actually just the very last bit of sort of from about 16 onwards, 16 to 19, you could sum up as, please give us what we don't deserve. And the particular thing theme, the series of things he'd love to see happen that he's longing God would give that they don't deserve is to do with the restoration of the temple, the sanctuary, the city, it's called different things, but basically that Jerusalem should be restored as the dwelling place of God and the place where his glory can be experienced and known. That was his great prayer. What is the answer to that prayer? Is there an answer to that prayer? We hear today that there is an answer, although it's not entirely straightforward, interpreting that answer. Let me say two caveats, that's two Warnungen, on passages like this, which are described, it's a form of biblical literature known as apocalyptic. Apocalyptic meaning unveiling. It unveils hidden things. And our danger with this sort of literature, I would suggest, is we end up being fascinated where we should be awed. By which I mean we're just fascinated by working out all the details of these sevens and weeks and all that sort of thing. And we don't actually stand back and react in awe to what is being revealed. You may remember I said, I think, two or three sermons ago, in some ways the impact of apocalyptic literature is more important than the particular interpretation. It's meant to have an impact on us. If it's not doing that, then we've missed the point. And the second thing to watch out for is being focused on what we don't know rather than on what we do know. And so again, we're busy trying to work out these mysteries and riddles and numbers and images, rather than saying, well, actually, let's focus on what we do know and draw lessons from that. Well, we'll see how we get on this evening. You may see what I mean as we head through the passage. Keep that in mind. So here's how his prayer was answered. First of all, it's answered in the form of a visitor. And in some way, the very fact there's this visitor is part of the message, is part of the answer. I gave the sermon, for some reason, known only to me and my subconscious probably, "The postman cometh." It's not a quotation from anywhere, even though it may sound that way, but postman as in the person who brings a message with him. And the messenger is called Gabriel. We all know about Gabriel, don't we? He appears in the New Testament. Zainama is program, really, for us. But why is he described as he is in verse 21? "While I was speaking in prayer, the man, Gabriel, whom I'd seen in the vision at the first." Why is he described as the man, Gabriel? That threw me off for quite a bit, because I'm trying to think, why is he not called an angel? Have we misunderstood Gabriel or what? But you need to look across the page, if it is across the page in your Bibles, at 8 verse 16, or 15 actually, which you looked at, I think, 2 weeks ago. "When I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I sought to understand it, and behold, there stood before me one having the appearance of a man, and I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai," and so on, "and it called, 'Gabriel, make this man understand the vision.'" So I think this is the angel Gabriel, this heavenly figure, but he's coming in the appearance of a man we saw there. And I think that's why it says that as it does in verse 21. Look at what we learn about his coming, or possibly what we learn about his departing. Why did he leave wherever the heavenly realms are that he was in? Why did he depart for this journey down? "While I was speaking in prayer," it says in verse 21, and then at the beginning of 23, "at the beginning of your pleas for mercy, a word went out," he says to Daniel. And look at the way he comes. Again, verse 21. "The man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the first, came to me in swift flight at the time of the evening sacrifice." There's a sense of urgency about it. I think I'm right in saying in the British Air Force, I don't know if it's the same in other places, the phrase when the alarm goes off and they need to get to their planes really fast to go up is called being scrambled, which, you know, doesn't make sense from the English of the word, but so it is sometimes. But they're scrambled means they get to their planes as quickly as they can and they take off. And it's a little bit like the angel Gabriel has been scrambled to get to that plane quickly, to get off quickly and deal with the situation. So that very fact that he departs as soon as the prayers begin, and the fact that he arrives swiftly, is part of the message to Daniel. If you like, a message by actions, not just words. And it says to him, "You are being listened to." Often we have to pray without having that assurance that he has, but here he's given this extra assurance by the angel appearing. Maybe that's a picture for us to keep in mind when we're praying, especially if we're praying with a certain urgency. Have in mind that picture. As you're praying, the angels are being scrambled to deal with the answer and so on. And if you think that's a little bit far-fetched, that the angels would be scrambled just for you, then Hebrews 1 verse 14 reminds us, are they, angels, not all ministering spirits, that is, serving spirits, sent out to serve for the sake of those who are to inherit salvation? They're there to serve us. Amazing. Or, you see, should be our reaction. There's another message in Gabriel's introduction before he gets on to the main message in the second half. And it's implied by the very fact that he's been sent, but it's stated as well, and it's the second half of 23, which I didn't read before. I have come to tell it to you, for you are greatly loved. That's a word used for something or someone who is very, very precious. You are greatly precious to God, he's told. Remember Daniel's situation, not an easy one. In exile, in social terms, in exile, in political terms, but there's a sense in which he's in exile in spiritual terms. He's away from the places which meant so much to him in his faith, the temple, Jerusalem and so on, the place where God dwells. All those great places of his faith have been destroyed. So it's hard not just to keep the faith, keep practicing it, but to keep believing it. There's a little hint here, incidentally, of one of the ways he does live, if you like, as an exile, but still in touch with his God. It's just a little hint in verse 21 at the end there. He came to me in swift flight at the time of the evening sacrifice. So why does he describe the arrival of Gabriel as at the time of the evening sacrifice? There are no sacrifices going on anymore. There's no temple, so there's no sacrificing. So why does he say that? It seems to be that he still tells his time by the temple clock. That's one of the ways he keeps his identity of one of God's people. In spite of all the efforts there are to make him assimilate to the culture and to the religious as well as the social culture, he makes sure in a number of different ways that he's still in exile, living as a citizen of Jerusalem. I suppose it's a little bit like Brits abroad, setting their watches and their clocks by the chimes of Big Ben when they listen to the BBC World Service. Don't laugh. We did that in our family when we lived overseas, so it does happen. That's a little bit living in exile. You're still wanting to sort of identify with the times. And so he identifies with the religious times of Jerusalem. But however much he may try to keep his spiritual routines going, he's a long way from home. He's in a foreign culture where few others share his convictions. And even his convictions may cause him to question if the temple is the Lord's dwelling place, where is he now? Has he disappeared out of sight? Is he still bothered with his people? And so on. And Daniel here receives just the assurance he needs to hear. He is much loved, present. He can ignore any inner voices or any external voices which are trying to tell him that the Lord isn't bothered with him. God cares enough to send his messenger to speak with Daniel personally. That was what Daniel needed to hear. And maybe there are one or two here this evening who need to hear that. Maybe God brought you along tonight especially to hear that and nothing else. Whatever your circumstances, whatever is going on in your life at the moment to make you wonder, you are greatly loved if you are one of God's people, in our terms, a follower of Jesus Christ. So that was like the message in inverted commas, because largely it was just an implied message rather than a spoken message. It wasn't the main content, but it's certainly the very fact of the visitor is in itself a message. Now we move on to the actual words that he was primarily given to deliver, and my heading is a riddle with a question mark after it, also Rätsel, Fragezeichen. When you first read it, it sounds a bit like a riddle, doesn't it? A sort of mathematical problem that needs solving. 70 weeks made up of an initial 7 and then 62, and then 1 week made up of 2 halves. One of the usual understandings is that we see the 7 weeks as 7 times 7, and it means 70 times 7, 70 weeks of years. The week implies 7, so it's 70 times 7. So 490 altogether, broken up into 70, 620, and 10. That's one of the ways of understanding it. And so people get out their calendars and calculators and start trying to decode it. Which was the year zero which began? And how can we work out these different numbers so they land somewhere around about Jesus? Because it must be about Jesus, mustn't it? And that's where those two caveats come into play. Let's not be fascinated where we should be awed. Let's not be focused on what we don't know rather than what we do know. And I think there's another reason why the rush to calendars and calculators may be unwise. We need to hear this as Daniel heard it. It was a message for him, not to us in the first place. And he wouldn't have had the calendars that we have of the next few centuries to consult. We can look at those from now and see what happened in those centuries and try and piece it together. But he couldn't have done that. He wouldn't have known that the end of the 490 years is supposed to land somewhere around the first century AD. And even if he had, what comfort would it have been for him to know that on a certain day, 490 years in the future, an anointed one would come? That's to say, don't misunderstand me, knowing that an anointed one would come would be welcome news. It would tell him that the throne of Israel is occupied once again. It would give him assurance about who was on the throne and who was calling the shots. But as far as Daniel's concerned, whether it happens in 50 years' time or 300 years' time or 490 years' time is pretty immaterial, because he's not going to be around for it. So listening it to him, his point of view, I don't reckon he'd have been reaching for his calculator. I think he would have been less fascinated by the details than we tend to be. I think it would be more natural to him to concentrate on the things he did know. I don't think he would have bothered to do the math. Yes, that was the thing there. So what I'm saying is Daniel... Oh, sorry, I've said that already. I wanted to add another little hint in the same direction. The word apocalyptic, I said, means unveiling, enthüllen or something. Well, if it remains, if it's just a riddle, a Rätsel that's very hard to solve, what is there that's unveiling about that? It seems to me that the very nature of apocalyptic must mean it does reveal something with some clarity. And that also makes sense of what we know about other things we know about apocalyptic literature. It tends to be expressing things that are beyond us, either beyond our understanding or beyond our sight. So it's telling us about what is happening in the spiritual realms where the angels are busy and so on. And it expresses those things, for example, with images. You may remember the last two sermons in the series, last but one and last but two, chapter 7 and 8, were visions and dreams of beasts of all sorts. And we read it that wasn't literally about beasts, it was images of human empires. And I think in a similar way, often apocalyptic literature uses numbers symbolically. They're not meant to be taken very literally. They're meant to express things that are beyond us. So you may know of the dimensions of the New Jerusalem described in Revelation 21. It's 12,000 stadia by 12,000 stadia. And you think, oh, it's a very exact, precise city. It must have been designed and built by Germans. But actually, you then discover it's also 12,000 stadia high. So the great New Jerusalem is actually a cube. But actually, it's symbolic numbers. It's telling you about the perfection of the city, not about the very specific, you know, get out your measuring tape and work it out. These numbers are very often meant symbolically. Perhaps one other thing about how fulfillment works, and I'll gloss over this a little bit. I won't go into it in depth, but it may make sense to some and help some, and I might refer to this in a minute again. The fulfillment of the prophecies in apocalyptic, and not just apocalyptic actually, but let's focus on that, it doesn't necessarily happen just on one occasion. And I find it helpful to think of three areas of fulfillment. So there's usually an immediate fulfillment that's going to happen in the near term, in probably in the lifetime or near lifetime of the prophet. Then there's what you might call a typical fulfillment. So quite often we then get this feeling that that fulfillment that's going to happen on immediately isn't going to be the last of the fulfillments of the same type. There are going to be lots of different fulfillments like this. So you may remember we thought about the beast. It was one particular beast. The Roman Empire was meant by that final beast. But you also had this sense as you read it, actually, maybe the Roman Empire isn't going to be the last beast. It's going to be typical of the beasts, the evil empires to come. And thirdly, you often get a sense of an ultimate fulfillment. So from Antichrist with a small a to the Antichrist with a big A, if you like, to the beast in capital letters, that also we looked at before. All that's really just leading us to say that what is unveiled, I think, is not so much details as the big principles and themes. Those are the things we should be looking out for. So with that in mind, let's try to listen to this through Daniel's ears. What is the meaning for him from where he was looking forward? And again, I'm not going to go into this in great depth, partly because of what I said about details, partly because of time, partly because it's quite complicated. But let's try and get the main themes clear. Looking forward, there are six things on God's agenda we hear in verse 24. Now, three are what you might call negative, dealing with sin. So to finish the transgression could also be translated to bring to an end rebellion. Secondly, to put an end to sin. Thirdly, to atone for iniquity, zuna tun. So that's all to do with dealing with the problem of sin. And the next three are more the sort of positive fulfillments, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal both vision and prophet, and we won't go into what that might or might not mean, and to anoint a most holy place. It could be a place, it could be a person, but it could very well be referring to what Daniel is longing for, the restoration of temple worship, the holy place being inaugurated again, in some sense. Those three things, more positive. If you like, those three last things, looking towards the alternative society that will be set up. Something to look forward to, in other words. But probably Daniel's thinking, when is all that going to happen? Remember, he started his prayer with 70 years are up. It's time to do it, Lord. Well, it's hard to tell when this is all going to happen, even though the timings are then described in the next verses. Partly for no other reason that we don't know when the starting gun is fired. We don't know when do you start counting the 70 weeks or the 70 weeks of years or whatever it might be. But maybe there's something more worrying for him in the general tenor of what follows. So 25 does tell us about the restoration he's longing for. Know therefore and understand that from the going out of the word, that's the starting gun. We don't know when that was, so we don't know when to start counting from. From the going out of the word to restore and build Jerusalem, to the coming of an anointed one, a prince, there shall be 7 weeks. And then for 62 weeks it shall be built again, presumably the great city, the holy place, with squares and moat, but in a troubled time. And after the 62 weeks, an anointed one shall be cut off and shall have nothing. And the people of the prince who is to come, what is this prince who is to come going to do? And you immediately think, okay, this is going to be the ultimate bringing in of the wonderful kingdom. It says, the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, which have just been rebuilt in the 62. Its end shall come with a flood, and to the end there shall be war. Desolations are decreed. They're definite. So he's told, you're going to get your restoration, and then after the restoration there's going to be another destruction. And then what goes on to happen? He shall make a strong covenant with many for 1 week, and for half of the week he shall put an end to sacrifice and offering. This could be a reference to the cross, where no more sacrifices would be needed anymore. And on the wing of abomination shall come one who makes desolate, until the decreed end is poured out on the desolator. So, return is the wrong word there. Did it say return for you? Yeah, sorry, return isn't quite the right word. After the destruction, there'll be possibly a repeat, I think may have been the word I meant, of restoration again in some way. But the main point here, for all the little details, the main point is this. Daniel, if you are one of the ones who gets back to Jerusalem, and you experience the temple being rebuilt, that won't be the end of history. That will be a temporary restoration, a temporary rebuilding. We can see that that is what happened. Ezra and Nehemiah rebuilt the temple. It got trashed again by the Romans, AD 70. But he seems to me that that is clear here, that there's going to be the restoration, then the destruction, and then maybe a repeat of that, or maybe heading towards that ultimate restoration. So, what does this mean for Daniel? I think Daniel is being encouraged to have a very long breath, as they would say in German, i.e., not to expect everything to change very quickly. And actually, it didn't happen quite in his lifetime, so probably this was given not just for him, but for those around him, so that when that happened, they wouldn't be shattered when the restoration didn't go on forever. So I think that's the sort of way it would have made sense to him looking forward. An encouragement, because God knows what's coming and is in charge, but also a warning of quite hard times to come. And finally then, what about the lesson, what does it mean for us looking back? In a sense, being able to fill in the gaps a bit, because we know what did happen, as I've been filling in some gaps as I've spoken. When were those 6 things accomplished that were on God's agenda, these things in verse 24? Have they been accomplished? Finishing the transgression, putting an end to sin, atoning for iniquity. Well, one way of understanding it is to say those were dealt with at the cross. Well, you could say that a sin is still around, so they haven't been finally put to death. And what about these other things? To bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal both vision and prophet, to anoint a most holy place, perhaps re-establishing worship and so on. Those are the sorts of things which will only be will only have happened properly and completely when God's kingdom is established, is what the way we would understand it. We might want to say that we have some experience of it now, but the fullness of it still lies in the future. So we see some fulfillment here of God's agenda, but also some still to come, even in our day, still lying in the future. Okay, let me jump in and try a possible explanation of the 70 times 7. Again, not wanting to be dogmatic about this, but a suggestion. First of all, the less important, this could be the specifics, if you like. The 70 years, I'm going to lose count, 70, referring in some way to the return to Jerusalem associated with Ezra and Nehemiah, and the rebuilding of the temple and the restoring of temple worship back then. The 620 would then be referring to the period between Ezra and Nehemiah and the first century. And then we get this 1 week, one lot of seven, whatever we're supposed to understand by that, which is divided in two. And we could understand that as, if you like, the 3.5, the first half is talking about the ministry of Jesus leading up to the cross. And that the second half of that week refers to the last days. So again, it's not specifically that amount of time, but it's a defined amount of time, the last days. That's the sort of specific, but I think it's more helpful to think of this in not more general terms, perhaps more general terms. And one of the commentators I read, Dale Ralph Davis, helped me think a bit like this. Maybe to see the 7 years, that first phase, is a relatively limited time when hope returns. The temple's restored and so on. And when the immediate fulfillment happens. And then the 62 years is a relatively lengthy time, again, without worrying about the exact details, a relatively lengthy time when a spiritual battle is raging. When, what was it, if I can find it quickly, at the end of verse 25, so 62 weeks, it shall be built again with squares and moat, but in a troubled time. So a rebuilt city and a restored worship and everything, but in a troubled time. So the spiritual battle is still raging. And maybe that is the typical fulfillment, that this is the sort of thing which will happen as God's purposes are being fulfilled bit by bit. Things are building to the great climax, which is then the last week, the climactic time, if you like, when evil comes to a head. So is that referring to the cross, or is it referring to the return of Christ? But you see this process whereby, as I've mentioned before, if you like, all the different beasts are building up to be the great beast. All the antichrists are becoming the antichrist. And I think there's a hint here of that ultimate fulfillment, which actually was expressed in his vision many years before in 725. He shall speak words against the Most High and shall wear out the saints of the Most High and shall think to change the times and the law. And they, that is God's people, shall be given into his hand, into the hands of the beast for a time, times, and half a time. So the spiritual battle, we've been told, will keep raging. It was there in that dream, and it's still going on here. But there will come this climactic time, this final week, when things will be sorted out. And I'll talk about that let me just point you to then the very last bit. On the wing of abominations shall come one who makes desolate until the decreed end is poured out on the desolator. So if you like, that could be pointing to the ultimate defeat of evil, of the final Antichrist figure or whatever, the culmination of everything. There is a decreed end. God has set the date. It's in his calendar. That would be one way of understanding it. Hopefully, we've not got fascinated with dates again, because we need to step back and be in awe at what is going on here and try to focus on what we do know. So I close with these two things that we do know. We know the response to prayer by the Lord. He sends his angels. He sends them immediately. He sends them to do an ongoing work. And he sends them to do the long-term, ultimate, culminating work of establishing the kingdom. There is a response. Prayer does not go unanswered. And God does have the resources to act. Or, therefore, Ehrfurcht, because we worship a great God who is bothered, who is committed to us, who does love us greatly, and is not indifferent to our situations. And the other thing we know with Daniel is the result. The final result, the outcome, is certain. It's in God's calendar. And you may remember that verse in Revelation. Satan knows that his time is short. It's certain, but it's not soon as we might long for it to be. So that warns us against any promises of an immediate, quick fix. All through history, since the time of Christ, there have been millenarian visionaries, false prophets, who said the time is come. All this stuff's about to be fulfilled. Some of you may have heard of the Zwickau prophets, local to here, in the Reformation, who basically went overboard thinking they had got the fulfillment and the return of Christ was coming and they were his special messengers and so on. And all through history we've had that. We need to be very, very cautious when people start saying, look, this is it, and getting obsessed with the details being fulfilled. The important thing, the result is certain. It's in God's calendar. That should comfort us. Let me close with the summary of this writer, Dale Ralph Davis. Some of you will know of him. But I won't finish with that. I will finish with the scriptures in just a sec. But let me read his summary. He has a wonderful, pithy way of putting things. What is the message of Daniel 9, 24 to 27 to Daniel and to us? It's something like this. We are called to a long obedience. You may know that phrase, a long obedience in the same direction. God's people will be sustained even in distressing times. And the great hater of God's people sits in the Lord's crosshairs. That means in his sights of his rifle, so to speak, with the date of his end clearly marked on God's calendar. You may have wished for more than that, but that's mostly what Daniel 9, 24 to 27 is about. And that's not bad. And I might add, that is a reason to worship this great God, and it's reason to trust him. And I close repeating some of the words from that vision of chapter 7. And we've heard the vision that the final great beast would give God's people a really hard time. Verse 25, for many years, for a time, times, and half a time, a long time. And then, but the court shall sit in judgment, and his dominion shall be taken away, the dominion of the beast, to be consumed and destroyed to the end. And the kingdom And the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. Their kingdom, our kingdom, shall be an everlasting kingdom. And all dominions shall serve and obey them, us, because we are part of this great process culminating in the great judgment. And you may have noticed after both of those dreams there and in chapter 8, Daniel was pretty unwell for a while. He was shocked, he was shaken. And maybe it is because of this thing. The end is certain, but it's not soon. And he knew it was going to be hard work. And maybe it was a disappointment to him to say the return to Jerusalem isn't going to be the final end of history. It was a shocking news, if you like, but comforting. Because God is in control. Whatever is going on in your life at the moment, whatever is going on in the lives of the nations at the moment, God is in control and he is establishing his kingdom. Amen.